The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. See, Derek Varn is on the podcast again, this time to discuss Lukács's 1920 essay, Class Consciousness. It's late on Wednesday, January 31st, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you haven't already, you might sign up to our membership podcast through our Patreon account. Conversations like this one with Varn are fairly common on that channel. You'll also hear Varn on the Symptomatic Redness podcast more regularly through the Patreon feed, including a recent essay exploring the power of and some of the contradictions in the DSA. As far as Zero Books titles that are worth reading, consider picking up Anjelim Jappe's The Writing on the Wall, Jason Barker's novel Marx Returns, or Sean Scott's Millennials and the Moments That Made Us. The music you're listening to right now is a ukulele cover of It's Only a Paper Moon. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Varn and I discuss class consciousness.
I brought up the essay, which is Class Consciousness, written in 1920 by Lukács.
Let me backtrack for a second and really help our listeners understand what's at here. So you and I have been talking about the shift from economics to economics and culture to pure culture, like in the grand history of the modern left, both Marxist and in some ways non-Marxist. And you and I have both picked on Lukács before because of his specific ideas of class consciousness and his ideas about class and Hegel. Lukács is considered like a Hegelian Marxist in the phenomenology sense as opposed to the science of logic sense. And to bring that dichotomy, I think that the dichotomy may be oversimplified, but there have been a few scholars who have said if you looked at early 20th century Marxism, the humanists have tended to focus on – the humanists and the left communists have tended to focus on the phenomenology, and Lukács was among them. And then the harder line Stalinist had focused on the science of logic. The issue with that is that's actually sort of –
I can think of one
vulgarization.
Yeah,
you know?
I can think of one major exception to that rule, which is Raya Duenyaskaya, who suggested that reading phenomenology was misleading and that you had to start with logic.
Yeah, well, I tend to think that what you see, and this is doesn't make anyone look good, is the distinctions between the left opposition and Stalinism are thinner than we like to pretend. Mm. There's a lot of things in the Lukács that comes out of Hegel in specific that I think gets to this point. And you and I are going to have to, you know, in a way, this takes us all the way back to how you and I started our, you know, now 7 year long dialogue in 2010, 2011. We were arguing about Hegel and you were sympathetic to Althusser, but you didn't like his anti-Hegelianism, and I was not sympathetic to Althusser, but I did sort of like his anti-Hegelianism.
Right.
And I think we both moderated away from that, but I think a lot of those fundamental differences are going to come up today because some of the problems I have with this are going to be the same problems that I would have with Ruta Donskaya or with someone like Dominic Losorto, who's an Italian. People call him a Stalinist. I'm not 100% sure it's true, but an Italian thinker who tries to reconcile Marxism with the philosophy of right and things like that. So we kind of have to – we're going to have to go into the weeds with Hegel a bit. But there's also so much here and so little here simultaneously, because one of the things that I want to do when we talk about this – and this may end up being a very long conversation – is I want to both straw man and steel man a lot of these arguments. So what I mean by that is I'm going to try to present the weakest form of reading this to explain some of the ways Lukács has been used poorly.
Mm-hmm.
And the most – from our perspective, the most sympathetic reading and still see what the problems are, because I think you have to with this, partially because as a stylist, Lukács is hard.
Yes.
Like there are times when I read him and I can read him in two diametrically opposed ways. And I'll give you a couple of examples of that when we actually get into the weeds. But – It's interesting. I do. There's a couple of things I wanted to point out to you, Doug, and it was interesting because I noticed it before. I was reading Hal Draper's book on Marxist theory of revolution and politics, and he asserts, and I think actually kind of accurately, that Marx never actually defines capitalism. He describes it in terms of his political economy and critiques that. But there's no like beginning axiomatic definition of capitalism in Marx that you can find it clearly spelled out what it is. You get descriptions of how it functions and how that functions produce different kinds of value, what those values are. And those all start from an assumption of Ricardo and Smith, and they kind of tease out some things. There are innovations in there, you know, like surplus value and whatever, but those innovations come from trying to read the classical political economy like sui generously and actually sympathetically, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with that assertion that's what's going on?
I would say that if you read Capital, by the end of reading Capital Volume 1, in any case, I'll just talk about my own experience reading the book. I felt as though I had at least a grip, maybe not a firm grip, on an understanding of capitalism where I could start to define it. And that for me, the fact that Marx started with the commodity form at the beginning of Capital was significant, and that a good way to describe capitalism is that it is a social formation in which the emphasis or the whole aim of society is the production of commodities.
Yeah, and that's interesting to talk about when you talk about how Marxism works differently from other forms of philosophy. So if you look at historical materialism, one of the things is you actually start out describing the structures inherent. Now we can get into like some actually kind of legitimate points in post-structuralism about these descriptions that they do actually hide some definitional things, depending on how you look at it. But I don't even think that Marx would disagree with that. But he doesn't start off like you would in analytic philosophy or even in classical dialectic philosophy. And by classical dialectic, I mean pre-Hegel, where you state your axiom first.
Right.
There you don't see capitalism defined with like what I consider reading Capital's volume 1, 2, and 3, and even admittedly there being problems with volumes 2 and 3, that you could kind of come up with a three-pronged definition of capitalism, and that actually sort of makes it distinct from the way, like, say, libertarians talk about it, because it consists of markets, banking, and reinvestment creating surplus value, right? Mm-hmm. And other societies have had any two of those things, but only capitalism has all three.
See, I would say capitalism is a mode of production primarily, that it's about the production of commodities, and that these other categories that you mentioned are necessary for this way of life to exist, for this aim to happen.
So, and you and I will talk about this a lot of times, like, and there's going to be all kinds of stuff that comes up from this Lukacs conversation, I feel, actually.
Right.
But that you and I are saying very similar things. We are focusing on different parts of the thing.
Right.
And that difference of focus actually matters. And I'm not going to disagree with you on that. So if you focus on commodity production, and I actually do too, but it does lead to things like trying to figure out where, like, say, service sector workers fit in capital, whereas other readings can still maintain that definition and not have that problem. Because they're focusing their crucial axis of what's important is different. Now, I actually agree with you. Commodity production is the defining definition of capitalism. But what makes commodity production and capitalism unique is surplus value.
Right. Yeah. 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 So, you know, and in order to get that kind of exploitation going in a capitalist society, in order to have a capitalist society, a lot of other things already have to have occurred. You know, you're not starting. What's strange about capitalism is it doesn't really start with its core. It becomes capitalism. There's a process there, and which is, you know, I'm dipping into Hegel in a way just by using the word become, which shows you how rarefied this conversation is. But you use a common, you know, word, become, and it's freighted with way too much.
Yeah, I mean, even a distinction like in itself and of itself, as opposed to in itself and for itself. And for people who aren't Kant, Hegel scholars, that tiny distinction seems like nothing. But for people who are Kant, Hegel scholars, it has massive implications for epistemology, ontology, metaphysics. I mean, it's just crazy, actually. I would literally say the difference between, say, Foucault's theories and Marx's theories, one of the key ones is actually that weird Kantian Hegelian distinction. Now, I also, and I think you wouldn't disagree with me on this, although you would disagree on how profound this is, do not think you can say Marx is cleanly a Hegelian. There are caveats there. You tend to think Marx's problems tend to be when he veers off of Hegelianism, and I tend to think that where Marx is saying the most interesting things is when there's a conflict there. But we have to just clarify the methodology. So, and I bring that up because this is the very first assertion in the Class Consciousness essay from 1920 that is the beginning of History and Class Consciousness, the book. This is translated by the Rodney Livingstone, and you can find it for free on the internet. And that is, Marx's chief work, and I'm quoting Lukacs here, breaks off as he is about to embark on a definition of class. This omission was to have a serious consequences for both the theory and practice of the proletariat. For the vital point, the later movement was forced to base itself on interpretation on the collation of occasional utterances by Marx and Engels and on the independent extrapolation and application of their method. Now, as a side note, we'll talk about some weird stuff that from another Lukacs essay that comes up on that method question. But so Lukacs starts off with pointing out that Marx doesn't actually ever really and truly and completely define class. And when you go look for definitions of, like, say, working class and proletariat, you literally have to look in excise footnotes and stuff. Like,
I hope I don't bore you with this. I find Kant's ethical theory exciting, and I'm gonna try to make it exciting, because to this day, it is probably the highest achievement of this society, and you can call it bourgeois, you can call it whatever you want to, using Max Weber's terms. That, for now, is not the argument. It's a new kind of society is enough for now. And Kant's argument is about how individuals in this society should judge their actions in terms of right and wrong. He says, well, you know, some things are moral. There's a moral law. There's some things that are right and wrong. That isn't questioned by Kant. Later philosophers, I will argue, do question it. Kant just goes, yes, some things are moral. Now, that belief for Kant as a human being was based on being raised by a couple of really good pietist parents. And it was just unthinkable to him that in their whole lives they had never once obeyed a moral law. And in the empirical world, if a moral law had been obeyed even once, then Kant's style of arguing would allow him to argue based on that presupposition, how is it possible that there be a moral law? That is a standard form of Kantian questioning, is to look at a practice and then ask about that practice. What are the conditions for the possibility of it? That is the first meaning of critique, a dangerous new form of thought that enters the world with the bourgeois era. Critique.
What we're saying here is, one, you actually have to look at Marx's methodology to figure out what Marx is saying. Two, there is a truth asserted, and it's been noticed by different scholars, both, you know, who had actual relationships to Marxist states like Lukács did, or who were sort of ad hocing it and had informal educations like Hall Draper, who did notice separately that there are no axiomatic definitions in Marx. Like, that a lot of times when we say Marx defines capitalism as thus, what we are actually doing is glossing his description and then taking that gloss as the definition.
Yeah. Right, which that's really important, because Hegel is not an axiomatic philosopher. He doesn't start with axioms. In the phenomenology, he spends a great deal of time explaining why he doesn't start by stating his premises or start by stating his conclusions and then proving them.
Right. It is a methodologically different way of doing philosophy than even most Marxists. I mean, even the people who go on and on, like Trotskyists, who go on and on the most about like how our logic is fundamentally different, blah, blah. They often actually methodologically work like analytic philosophers. They state a definition, they make an assertion, and then they go to prove it. So they work – they actually work deductively, not dialectically. And part of that is because it's hard to define after Hegel exactly what dialectics is, other than it has to do with ideas and history. And then when you get to how Marx inverts that, it gets even harder, because you're not dealing with ideas so much as the relationships that produce the ideas. And it seems like Adorno says in Resignation, he says it implicitly, but I think it's what's implied in that essay, is that you get stuck trying to figure out how to break circles. Right. How if the consciousness, I mean, in a way, Adorno's actually responding to Lukács too directly. If consciousness emerges out of the primary class contradiction between bourgeois and capitalist, I mean, not bourgeois and capitalist, bourgeois and proletariat, then why do we assume that that relationship does not distort the consciousness of the proletariat itself? Like, and if it does, your only way out of it is a lot of things that Engels says, not what Marx says, because Engels is a person who takes the Brumaire, that assertion in the Brumaire about, you know, human history, and he transhistoricizes it. And I'm going to get in trouble for saying that that's not that Marx doesn't do that, because I've been arguing with people about it for a while. But – and Marx doesn't correct him on this. So maybe Marx did, but it doesn't seem to be – Marx is not willing in his own writing to go that far.
Okay. So let's just clarify what that sentence is.
So yeah, I'll give you the assertion from Brumaire, and I'll give you what Lukács actually asserts.
Okay.
It is what I consider the elaboration of the thesis on Feuerbach, where he says that the purpose of prior history has been to understand – truth and reality, and now our purpose is to change it. But where he actually states how we do that is in the Brumaire, and that is, men make their own history, but they do not make it as they please. They do not make it under self-selective circumstances, but under circumstances already existing, given and transformed from the past.
Yeah. Now, I don't see how that particular statement is, as abstract as it is so contentious? Why you be?
I actually think it's true, but I just think
it wouldn't be necessary to worry about being transhistorical about that statement. Because
right. Well, but let me give. But I'll tell you why, though. I think it is a problem. Okay. To be transhistoricized, what it means. And you and I noticed this in something we said offline, and you actually looked up the entire quote, which I looked up too. Lukacs pulls out quotes from Inkles, "Nothing happens without intent."
Oh, right. Okay.
How he reads, how he is reading the same kind of assertion Marx is making. I actually don't think that's the same assertion Marx is making, because Marx does seem to imply that intent is important, and that now we have – but now's the only time we have the ability to make that intent conscious. But let me go and tell you how far Hegel takes this. So this is the
– I mean, you mean Lukács, not Hegel.
Not Hegel. Excuse me.
Yeah.
How far Ingles takes this. But Ingles takes this from Hegel.
Okay. Right. Okay.
Ingles tries to read biology this way. In the Dialectics of Nature, he asserts – and I was arguing about whether or not this is a Lamarckian – but he asserts that the first conscious change that separated men from animals is that we evolved our hand by doing labor. Now, I pointed out that this is wrong because it's Lamarckian. You can't blame – and I didn't mean this as a critique of Ingles, because Ingles is working off of contemporary science.
Right.
And there were some people who thought that at the time, but it's just not true that we did not evolve our hands by doing labor. Because that's not how genetic selection works. And he reads that in the Dialectics of Nature, and basically to argue that the history of man is a history of intentionality. And he goes further, like when he actually does the whole Feuerbach in the end of classical German philosophy, which takes the theses of Feuerbach and expands it into a whole book.
Right.
That's where that quote, "Nothing happens without intent," comes from. And in fact, also Nature is brought up. And I'll just read the quote, because you and I were talking about this specific quote. In one point, however, the history of the development of society proves to be essentially different from that of nature. In nature, insofar that we ignore man's reactions upon nature, there are only blind, unconscious agencies acting upon one another, out of whose interplay the general law comes into operation. Nothing else happens, whether in innumerable apparent accidents observable upon the surface or in ultimate truths which concern the regularity inherent in these instances, happens as a consciously desired aim. In the history of society, on the contrary, actors are all endowed with consciousness, and this is where Lukács picks up on consciousness, is this quote.
Right.
Are men acting with deliberation or passion towards a definite goal?
Yeah.
Nothing happens without conscious purpose, without intended aim.
Yeah.
But this distinction, as important as it is for historical investigation, particularly of a single epochs and events, cannot alter the fact that the course of history is governed by inner general laws. For here, also, on the whole, in spite of the consciously aimed desire of all individuals, accidents apparently reign on the surface. That which is willed happens but rarely. In the majority of instances, numerous desired ends cross and conflict with one another. Are these ends in themselves are incapable of realization? Are the means of attaining them are insufficient? Thus, the innumerable individual wills and the individual actions in the main of history produce a state of affairs entirely analogous to the prevailing in the realm of unconscious nature.
Right.
But the ends of actions are intended, but the results which follow from those actions are not intended, or they do not seem to correspond to the end intended. They ultimately have consequences quite other than those intended. Historical events thus appear as a whole likewise to be governed by chance. But where the surface accidents hold sway, there's always governed by an inner hidden law, and only by the matter of discovering these laws. Or else, everything meaningful or purposive is banished from history. It becomes impossible to advance beyond mere individuality of the various epochs and their social and human representatives. I.e., I'm going to take a break from this. Foucault does this. Foucault actually talks about epochs.
I thought about you saying that about Foucault when I read that line, by the way. Go on.
Yeah, we'll pick back up. But yeah, so you knew I was going to bring that up. History must then be with Ranke in every age, equally close to God, i.e. has attained an equal degree of perfection, and that for quite different reasons there is no such thing as historical development, which also is something Foucault says explicitly without ever having read this. But So that seems to contradict what, you know, Engels, sorry, this gets into the name similarity problem. Engels is, you know, Dialectics of Nature, where he talks about man's intentionality as well. And this does seem more on point than Lukács as far as that Brumaire quote. So like Engels isn't saying anything we would happen to disagree on. There are laws about societies that emerge. There are also intention. But what it does seem to imply in Lukács, and I'll get to a quote where I just hit a wall. And this is from the same essay, it's towards the end, and we'll probably have to work back from here. But in Hegel's parlance, and this is Lukács, not Engels. In Hegel's parlance, the economy has not even objectively reached the stage of being for itself, i.e. being conscious of itself in Hegelian terms. I'm just defining that for our listeners. There is therefore no possible position within the society from which economic basis of all social relations could be made conscious. But by implication, and this is me talking, there is a way, if we develop consciousness, that social relations can be conscious of themselves. What does it mean for an economy? And I say this as a question to you and trying to understand Lukács. What does it mean for an economy to be conscious of itself? What does it mean for – and to use Donatian language, this is the idea that thinks itself. But this implies that the idea has a brain and that the aggregate has a consciousness beyond its components. What does this mean in Lukács and in materialist things? It's clear to me that in Hegel, it either means God or it means negativity, or maybe it actually probably Hegel meant both, but we're going to only be able to live with one of those answers.
Well, I think we could live with both answers. I think we could be like Hegel and believe in a God that is defined by a negative principle.
Right. The funny thing is, I was arguing with today is whether or not somebody said, well, that means that Hegel's essentially an atheist. And I'm like, well, I don't know. I really actually have no idea if that means that he's an atheist. I tend to think that means that he's, from a classical Christian perspective, he's a weird heretic. But he didn't think that. So, I mean, I don't know what to do with that. But anyway, to bring it back to this does mean, though, that Lukács is trying to say there's some kind of positive consciousness.
Yeah. This is the thing.
It would be of itself.
Okay, so
what does that mean?
I want to see if I can. I have a strange. I just had a strange experience with this, which is I thought I understood everything that was being said, and so let me see if I can explain it. So what distinguishes men from animals is that animals don't change their mode of life over time through their reason and intention. They're not free in the same way that human beings are. That's point one. Point two, human beings turn out to be far less free than they think. Yes, history is a story of progress, or in other words, actually just of change. And in certain ways you could measure progress, but what men collectively and individually aim at never arrives, or almost never arrives. Very rarely do we get what we set out to get. In other words, we're not transparent to ourselves, and the world isn't transparent to us. We can act upon the world, but we can't know in advance what the consequences are going to be of our actions. I mean, that's stated very baldly, and there are some areas where we can do very, you know, we can have some good predictions, but
you're right about that. But wouldn't this strike most leftists and even liberals today as conservative?
How so?
Because what it's saying is that, I mean, this sounds like a conservative argument. It's saying, for example, that the best laid plans of mice and men argument. I don't think it's truly a conservative argument as much as a factual argument.
No, because you have to get to the absolute for it not to be. In other words, you have to understand the significance of maybe two readings of Hegel, which is that one is that given that we are always going to make missteps, we're always going to have failures It's on us to forgive failure and to change, to try to fail better. The absolute is a moment of recognition of the negative.
Let me get to where the Lukancian Hegel does it, and I'm saying this because this is how they read Hegel into Marx, says almost the opposite, because they say Lukács says explicitly, bourgeois and proletariat are the only pure clashes in bourgeois society. They're the only classes whose existence and development are entirely dependent on a course taken by a modern evolution of production. Okay, so you and I still agree this. And from the vantage point of these classes, can plan for a total organization of society even be imagined? I don't know if we both agree with that, but we both agree with the first part. But this is where I really want to think about this. He ends up implying, though, that this is almost transhistorical, because he says that no prior epoch – well, maybe not transhistorical. That's not what I mean, but this is teleological. Let's put it – that no prior epoch could ever have done that from its own perspective. So that for example, once the proletariat actually does seize control of production, history ends and begins, because there is no more – theoretically, the proletariat has the ability not just to end this particular class conflict, but all class conflict.
Okay. Well, now we need to go back into talking about class, because one of the things that we've kind of left aside is the way that the subject of history is divided against itself through caste or class, and how we are kind of not for ourselves yet, you know? We're in ourselves and of ourselves, but not for ourselves yet, because we don't understand how, as a collective subject, we are inevitably divided.
And you and I, again, we're just going to say this. We would actually both agree with the statement, right, that most people – although I don't know that people don't understand that as much as some people seem to think. Like, part of my issue with this is this implies that consciousness is some arcane – ability to imagine yourself in a relationship to the totality of society, and that class consciousness is not the ability to understand interest or status, all right, but that relationship as a whole. And it's interesting because and while I was bringing up the status thing, and to bring it back here, I was just going to quote Lukács again. With the bourgeoisie, also class consciousness stands in opposition to class interests, but here the antagonism is not contradictory as in the proletariat, but dialectical. Why? And what does that actually mean? So he is saying that I think he's saying, and I might not even disagree with this, and I'm going to try to steel man this argument here. The bourgeois, because it is the dominant class in our current mode of history, also its interest and its long-term consciousness are opposed. But that opposition for it drives the development of capitalism. That is the most – and I would say, like, if you look at, say, like, politics in capitalist countries, which is almost all of them now, almost all countries are capitalists at this point, are in some degree our relationship. I mean, there are – weird hybrid thing, but there's nothing without some element of capitalism in it right now, including surplus commodity production. We have to say, like, okay, is it like it does seem that like what drives our politics and what drives business change is all this is the way interest is conflicted between bourgeois elements of our society. So different. You know, like if you look at, say, Wall Street versus real estate, Wall Street versus Silicon Valley, Silicon Valley versus the Sun Belt, all these kind of ways we tend to parse things in contemporary United States, for example. And they explain the differences between like the aggregate trend of Democrats versus the aggregate trend of Republicans, right? But those are immediate interests within bourgeois society. And Lukács is saying those actually blind bourgeois to their own class consciousness. But that since they're in the dominant position, that actually develops capitalism. I think that's what he's saying. I mean, I am deducing a whole lot from a snippet and a sentence in a 30 page essay, but that's like the most sympathetic reading I can give to that. And if that's the correct reading, is it true? What would that mean to say that class antagonism, I mean that class interest is antagonistic but not contradictory in the bourgeois but not the proletariat, and the proletariat is purely contradictory? Exactly what is that saying?
Okay, so the proletariat has a purely contradictory consciousness in regards to its relationship to the whole, or to one another, or to the bourgeoisie.
Well, I'll read the next paragraph.
Yeah.
The distinction between the two modes of contradiction may be briefly described in this way. In the case of other classes, a class consciousness is prevented from emerging by their position within the process of production and the interest that it generates. And this is like all other classes, not just a proletariat. In the case of the bourgeoisie, however, these factors combine to produce a class consciousness, but one which is cursed by its very nature with the tragic fate of developing an insolvable contradiction at the very zenith of its powers. A result of this contradiction is that it must annihilate itself. Okay, you and I would say to this, I think this is a fancy way of restating crisis theory.
That's what I would read it as too.
But crisis theory, in that the contradiction must sublimate, where you and I think that the crisis actually ends up driving capitalism, not annihilating it.
Right. But you got to understand that he's making this. There's a distinction here between the bourgeois class as
and the bourgeois mode of production
and capital itself. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, when a crisis occurs and capital is destroyed in order to be reborn, the individual capitalists, the bourgeois class, those people suffer. Some of them. And each one of them as individuals will, by theory anyway, reach a point where the only solution is for them to go out of business and sell off at a loss.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is inevitable.
And I'm going to bring this as a side point, because this is where our modern economy gets so opaque, are to make a deal with the state to limit competition. To thus slow the decline and rate of profits. And I do point that out because all the rich people in the world seem to come out of fields that have IP in it for a reason.
right.
For normies, intellectual property. And intellectual property, as libertarians and Marxists agree against kind of conservatives and liberals, intellectual property is a form of monopoly capital.
Right.
And this is one of the issues we agree with libertarians on. And it's a way of using the state to quote unquote distort the market. But the thing is, that's only where we disagree with libertarians is we think that's only possible as long as there's still enough commodity production to support that.
Right. Now, look, I think you're right in that, and these kinds of economic questions are really empirical. And I'm assuming something here that the crisis will drive every industry into foreclosure, that every business will eventually go away because of crisis. And I may be wrong there, but I think that if you just look at the bare crisis theory and you don't throw in the state as a countervailing force and you don't get too far into the weeds, that bare understanding might be what he's talking about anyway when he's referring to the bourgeois' classes' contradiction, where they see their own kind of destruction in their own process that they.
Yeah. So I'll read the next paragraph because I think this actually backs you up. But I want you and I have a problem with this essay. I don't want to get to the problem.
Right.
The distinction between I've already read that. The tragedy of the bourgeoisie is reflected historically in the very fact that even before it had defeated its predecessor, feudalism, although as a hashtag, feudalism is really poorly defined in Marxism, and we can get into that later, on a hashtag, its enemy, the proletariat, had appeared on the scene. Politically, it became evident when, at the very moment of victory, the freedom in whose name the bourgeoisie had joined in battle with feudalism against was transformed into a new repressiveness. Sociologically, the bourgeoisie did everything in its power to eradicate the fact that class conflict from the consciousness of society, even though class conflict had only emerged in its purity and become established as a historical fact with the advent of capitalism itself. Ideologically, we see the same contradiction in the fact that the bourgeoisie endowed the individual with unprecedented importance, but at the same time, individuality was annihilated by the economic conditions to which it was subjected by the reification created by commodity production. And you and I would totally agree with all that. It backs it's.
Although like, I think it might undo what we just said about crisis theory, because the real source of the political problems for the bourgeois class were okay. Well, look, you can become a little Hegelian here. The bourgeois promise was freedom.
Right.
And were not able to arrive at that freedom because they relied on a proletariat class, for production. So they needed to obscure the unfreedom that their project relied on, that promised freedom. But that's a completely different thing than their own problems in themselves and for themselves as a class.
So you would say that part of the issue is that this is actually two distinct problems, and that Lukács is actually conflating them.
I think I'm not sure. We could be misreading his first. He may not be referring to crisis theory at all. I mean, he could.
This is the thing. Like maybe my most charitable reading is wrong.
That's right. But if it isn't wrong, then I think we're talking about two different things. And I think a Hegelian way to say it is that, there's a problem for the capitalists or bourgeoisie themselves in themselves. And then there's a problem, for the bourgeoisie in relationship to the other, to the whole.
Right. So all these, I'm going to read the next paragraph to maybe clarify. I'm hoping all these contradictions in the list may be extended indefinitely. Are only a reflection of the deepest contradictions in capitalism itself as they appear in the consciousness of the bourgeoisie in accordance to their position in the total system of production. And this is where I start to go, are you sure?
Yeah, right.
For this reason, they appear as dialectical contradictions in the class consciousness of the bourgeoisie. They are not merely they do not merely reflect the inability of the bourgeoisie to grasp the contradictions inherent in their own social order.
Yeah, well, now a really funny thing is happening because the bourgeoisie are no longer individuals with their independent aims who happen to create a consciousness that is different from what they originally set out to create. I mean, that's the Hegelian read, right? I mean, there's a bourgeois consciousness which is not really contained in any individual. It emerges and is collective. And,
but I mean,
let me just get to what I'm saying here. Okay. So if you say that this is an emergent bourgeois consciousness, it's one that's actually, according to Marx, and I think, according to Hegel, it would be contained in the state maybe, or whatever the next political player was going to be, this new consciousness that emerged. Like, the bourgeoisie set out for freedom and they relied on unfreedom. And so, an awareness of that becomes collective, emerges, and a new player arrives through this dialectical tension, right? That's a Hegelian read. The Marxist read is that this way of life emerges materially and that it has its own logic and that it can operate materially without any of the bourgeoisie needing to have a political understanding of it.
So here's where I'm going to just do something and anglicize the way we're speaking about this.
Okay.
Because consciousness here has a double meaning.
Right. Well, that's the thing. It's like it's on one hand, it's a way of life. It's a practical way of material life. On the other, it's a political will or the will of an intent.
And Hegel, so when I speak normie, I refer to this. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. Hegel assumes that the intent changes and that there's always a political subject. Okay, now go ahead.
Okay, so I'm just going to speak normie for a second.
Okay.
So part of the problem with this consciousness and the reason why I'm speaking normie is stuff like standpoint epistemology is based off reading this collective consciousness thing as something that can manifest in the individual and lead to individual to have unique insights about their point in the social relations that can't be held otherwise. And I we'll get to the problems with that later. And we talked about it many, many times before. But that may be a misreading of Lukács. So if I'm being charitable, when we say consciousness, when we say class consciousness of the bourgeoisie, we mean something like its hidden rules that affect behavior that individual will makes, you know, doesn't negate. Or to put it in even simpler terms, it has a logic beyond what any individual member of it can know. So that we're not competing, so that we're not committing a part to whole fallacy or a whole to part fallacy, right? This is the fallacy that Marxists are constantly accused of, that we assume a part to whole or whole apart. I don't actually think we do. This might not yet be where we disagree with Lukács. I will actually get to the assertion he makes, and I mean, he's talking about feudalism, but I really cannot tell from reading around it if it seems like a transhistorical statement because it reads like one.
Look, I think we really need to land on consciousness here for a second and say that the distinction between a material logic and a way of life that's based on that material logic and an ideology is one that needs to be cleanly made. Because if you can't distinguish between those two things, and it's sometimes difficult, you do end up positing like some conspiratorial class that has that's the real source of the subjectivity.
Right. So I would actually say if I had to come to deal with two areas that I see that leftists make a mistake in constantly, it is one, forgetting that freedom, not planning, even though I'm not saying planning is not important, but freedom, not rational planning, was the goal of Marx and Engels, stated explicitly and picked up from Hegel and the German idealist explicitly. The rational planning was to enable freedom, not the other way around, and that our understanding of consciousness and logics mean that it's not because the bourgeoisie is bad or that they have a conspiracy to control the state, although sometimes they do. I mean, that this is not to say it doesn't happen. Or actually, I would actually go insofar as to say elements of the bourgeoisie do at all times. But it's elements. It's not like there is no dictatorship of the bourgeoisie. This is where I think people get like the bourgeoisie's class interest is not clear enough in line with this notion of consciousness for there be a clear dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, which is why even Marx in his offhand comment about the state, and I will just say Marx's theorizing about the state is underdefined because I don't believe in like the hard epistemological break, but it seems clear to me as he wrote Capital, he saw that the state problem was way harder to answer than he'd initially thought. And I say that because in like he says he originally planned to write a 5-volume, you know, set, one focusing on Capital, one focusing on the state, whatever. He never got done with even the Capital one. It ended up being three or four volumes, depending on how Engels edited it. It's just huge. So So I do think he started realizing that even if you define the state as the ruling committee of the bourgeoisie and its related classes, you know, bureaucratic and whatever, in a capitalist society, that this quickly gets like, oh, shit's way more complicated than I thought, particularly if we use the let's describe stuff and deduce the definitions from the description and not set the description – I mean set the definition out in the beginning. So OK. I'll tell you where I think this goes haywire.
I thought we had already covered a bit of where this goes haywire.
Well, yeah, but I want to tell you where I think he tried where I think Lukács is trying to make Hegel and Marx say the same thing and kind of dishonestly. Let me find my economic and legal categories are objectively and substantially so interwoven as to be inseparable. Lukács, which to me reads like, hey, what Hegel said about the state is right, and what Marx said about the economy is right, because there isn't really a difference. And I think that's kind of nuts.
I think that's just wrong. I mean, I do, you know, that gives politics – my problem with that is that would give the state more power than it has over controlling the economy.
Right.
I think the state is ideological in the same way that individuals are. And what I mean by that, and I'm using terms loosely. What I mean by that is, you know, when you set up with an, you start out with an intent, you try to act, with your will on the world and the results are not what you expect or want. That's the state's position as much as it is a capitalist position. And certainly, you know, and I don't even know the proletariat get to make that move.
Right.
But
so let's talk about why I found that important, because remember, you and I wanted to start out on a series. Maybe our listeners haven't grokked this yet, where we talk about the dual errors of economism on one hand and political economy. Economism is, and I'm going to define economism as Lenin and Engels did, which is where you assume that the economy will just automatically produce socialism because, you know, it has to. And political determinism on the other hand. And weirdly, a lot of people that have been accused of economism can easily also be accused of political determinism because they basically assume that the state controls the economy, even in bourgeois society. And this is where theories of MMT and kinds of under-consumptionist Marxism and like Marx-Keynesian hybrid post-Keynesianism and all that make a fundamental mistake. That isn't even about like what everyone argues about. Oh, they say that Marxists don't understand monetary theory. Okay, even if we don't. That's not even the point. Like, let's say, like I've said before to and people didn't get this as a criticism. They took me as agreeing with them. If there was a one or two world hegemon states that could make something like MMT work, that it either wouldn't be capitalism for a whole lot longer, or it assumes that in a system that somehow dissolves liquidity into value, but they would be able to assume commodity production forever. And I just don't understand what they think the logic for that would be. If we could just print money, and it would drive value, what would actually drive the economy anymore? And this is where I'm not sure that even if they were right, that it means what they think it means.
Right.
Like,
okay, so let's bring this back to consciousness. Why is consciousness important to this question? And why are they making an error that relates to consciousness when they embrace MMT? Can you answer that? Because I think I have a inkling, but I want to hear what you think of it.
Well, if I was going to answer this in the kind of Hegelian, Lukácsian way, I would say that most MMTers are are looking at a specific element of the management of capital, removing all class conflict from it, and trying both within a capitalist society and in the world at large, and trying to use that as a way to manage society. And this is where I'm going to, I think, kind of say maybe there is some usefulness to the consciousness interest distinction, because it's in the working class's immediate interest, but it would ignore the larger structural implications of what that would do to class relations, to the point to where it has to pretend that there would not that there would not be class conflict. Like, if you assume class conflict, right, then this does away with that in a sense, because it says that the conflict between the bourgeois and the proletariat is merely one of not understanding money relations. And according to Lukács, that is a very petty bourgeois way of thinking, because he says, I forget where he says it. Let me see if I can find the exact quote. The petty bourgeois have an interest to deny class antagonism, because they are a transitional class themselves, or they aren't really part of the driving conflict in society. And I would strictly speaking say academics aren't actually petty bourgeois, they would also have the same problem in that they aren't part of the primary thing either. They're tangential to it. And so imagining a kind of one quick fix based on one element of the problem would be really appealing if you were in that position, but it would ignore other laws of human interaction, like that there's no way anyone's ever going to allow that to happen politically.
Right. Okay, so here's the thing. This question of interest, to me, starts to become a distraction, because, again, once you fit someone within the system of capitalism and give them the task of working out what their interests are within it, they're mm-hmm. going to preserve capitalism. And that's regardless of whether they're a proletariat or a capitalist or petty bourgeois, because
right.
they're given a, you know, they may always lose, right? Like the proletariat always lose, but there's a game to play, and you have an interest in the capitalist system. Your interest is to increase your wages.
Right, which is why when you and I talk about trying to understand the way people actually act, you actually have to look at interest.
Right.
But that doesn't actually tell you what's going to happen with how capitalism works. And that's a crucial distinction. So if I want to predict like voting patterns or whatever within capitalism, I can do it based off of immediate interest.
Yeah.
That's kind of like an underlying substrate at law. Even if people don't – like even if individuals buck that interest, and individuals totally can. Like we are not assuming autonomy here. Yeah. It doesn't matter that an individual does it in aggregate, because when we talk about society, we are talking about aggregates. And I mean Marx says that explicitly. He actually uses the term. When you talk about society, you're talking about the aggregate. He actually doesn't – and it's interesting – that he uses the aggregate term, because, you know, everyone wants to talk about collectivism versus individualism. And if you think about aggregates, that actually makes that irrelevant, because what an aggregate is the way individuals work. But to understand – so you're not making a part-to-whole fallacy, the way individuals work versus the way people work in large groups. You have to look at the analytical question differently. So it isn't whether or not people like collectivize and work collectively, although that's important, like in terms of like getting stuff done.
Yeah.
But that's not actually what's at stake. So the whole collectivism and individual question, even from this perspective, is actually kind of irrelevant. We're looking at the difference between the way people events group interest versus group logic. Okay, to kind of break down the consciousness distinction a little bit there, and also individuals in aggregate don't work like either a collective mind or an individual mind.
Yeah, like, this is really important because when we talk about the ideology or the consciousness of the bourgeoisie, we're often talking about the aggregate consciousness. And in other words, we're not talking about the individuals and we're not talking about them getting together as a collective. We're talking about what the aggregate results are that sets up interests. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah. So, okay. So this is really important, and I think it might be missed that when we're looking for a radical subject, we're not looking for a positive radical subject. We're not looking for someone who, as they are now, can lead us to the revolution.
Right.
We're looking for someone who's willing to sacrifice their role in society with the hopes of creating something new.
Which is why the proletariat historically was the subject, is because there was no incentive for it to maintain its role in society, supposedly.
Well, there's some incentive, but they have the least to lose.
But not an aggregate,
yeah,
right?
Right, an like, aggregate, as an, right. In, yeah, right. They have the least to lose, and as an aggregate, there's no incentive. Right.
Right. As individuals, there's totally incentive, but like as an aggregate, no. But this is what. And let's get into. I want to get into the last four paragraphs then.
Okay.
Because this is where I think you and I may actually start to like make our differences with this way of thinking. Because so far it sounds like, hey, we agree with 90% of what Lukács is saying.
Well, Lukács doesn't say a lot of what we just said. A lot.
No, he doesn't. He glosses around it.
Yeah.
But we have to read it into it, right? So this is us steelmanning the argument. Right. So if we say if he means this, then yes, we agree with a lot of it. But there's also other ways to read this that don't necessarily mean that. And this is where I'll get to. I'll read the I'm going to read the last three paragraphs really quick. And I think in the view of great distances that the proletariat has to travel ideologically, it would be disastrous to foster any illusions. But it would be no less disastrous to overlook that the forces at work within the proletariat which are tending towards ideological defeat of capitalism. Okay. Every proletarian revolution has created workers' councils in an increasingly radical and conscious manner. That may have been true in 1920. Good fucking luck after 1921.
Yeah.
When this weapon is increased in power to the point where it becomes an organ of the state, the signs of class consciousness of the proletariat is on the verge of overcoming the bourgeois outlook of its leaders. And I'm going to pause and say bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll talk about why I think that's bullshit in a minute. The Revolutionary Workers' Council is not to be confused with opportunist caricatures. And I'm going to point out that this is where he starts using slippery language to like exclude certain forms of things. It's one of the forms of which consciousness of the proletariat has striven to create ever since its inception. The fact that it exists and is constantly developing shows that the proletariat already stands on the threshold of its own consciousness and hence on the threshold of victory. The Workers' Council spells the political and economic defeat of reification. In the period following the dictatorship, it will eliminate bourgeois separation of the legislature, administration, and judiciary, as if that's a good thing. And during the struggle for control of its mission is twofold. On one hand, it must overcome the fragmentation of the proletariat in time and space, and on the other, to bring economic and politics together in its true synthesis of proletarian practice. In a way, this will help reconcile the dialectical conflict between the immediate interest and the ultimate goal. Okay, I do kind of agree that that's a key point, but anyway. This must never overlook the distance that separates the consciousness of even the most revolutionary worker from the authentic class consciousness of the proletariat. And this is where you and I are going to have to say, does he mean consciousness the way we just spelled out, or does he mean something else? But in this situation can be explained on the basis of Marx's theory of class and class consciousness. The proletariat only protects itself by annihilating and transcending itself, which, again, you and I agree with, by creating a class of society through the successful conclusion of its own tragic struggle. The struggle for this society in which the dictatorship of the proletariat is merely a phase is not just a battle waged against an external enemy, the bourgeoisie. It is a battle of the proletariat against itself. Okay, which I do actually kind of agree with, against the devastating and degrading effects of the capitalist system upon its own consciousness. The proletariat will have only one real victory when it has overcome the effects within itself, the separation that should be united, the diverse stages of consciousness which the proletariat has reached and the various spheres of activity are the precise index of what has been achieved and what remains to be done. The proletariat must not stray away from self-criticism for the victory to be gained by the truth and must therefore be its natural element. And you will see now why everybody loves Lukács, because if depending on if you're a Trotskyist, a leftcom, and well, not everybody loves Lukács, but a lot of people, a lot of different tendencies love Lukács. You can find language in this last bit to justify your position, even like self-criticism stuff.
Yeah. Well, okay. So,
but let's just talk about like one, the first two paragraphs are objectively wrong.
Yeah.
Like, well, from our standpoint in 2018, they seem laughably objectively wrong.
Oh, yeah, sure. Okay, so there's that. And then, but the other thing is a lot of what he says doesn't follow if you're interpreting him the way we've interpreted him so far.
Right.
And the key is actually, I think he's reverting to a Hegelian perspective in which somehow that consciousness – remains at the level of ideas and isn't materialized, because the reason why things go wrong for human intention is because it interacts with a world outside of itself, and even internally, aspects of itself are separated away.
Yes, so I'll find the quote that I think agrees with this, and you can even put out. Pull the one key word that tells you this actually has some weird idealist stuff going on. Thus, we must never overlook the distance that separates consciousness of even the most revolutionary worker from the authentic consciousness of the proletariat.
Right. Right. Authentic. That is a very key word, right? I mean, the whole reason that – from my way of thinking, that you have human intention is because it is – separated, because it is misdirected, because it isn't just authentically connected to the world outside of itself.
Yeah, you and I made this point forever ago when we were talking about to Zarazin about that there is no unalienated consciousness.
Right. So recognizing that to me is a key part of class consciousness. Recognizing the responsibility of making mistakes and creating a world is a key part of class consciousness. In other words, for the proletariat, taking on the responsibility of creating a world and making mistakes is a key part of class consciousness. And that also means rearranging the relations within society. In other words, that's the internal rearrangement of society. That's the new subjectivity. Creating that new subjectivity is part of the project, but that subjectivity is never going to be just like an animal subjectivity where everything, you know, first of all, animal subjectivity just means no subjectivity, right? So there's no, you know, will. I mean, now I'm not saying animals don't have subjectivity in fact, but from this schema, they don't. Okay. So yeah, we're just, you can't make that move, towards authenticity. Without being mystified, without basically promising to square a circle. And this is just in the abstract, you know, historically, obviously things went very wrong. So what are the results of thinking this way? One of them is that you can posit that they can be a political party which formulates ideas in the name of the proletariat, which rather than posit that there needs to be a new structure of material life, which eliminates the whole category of proletariat.